You're listening to On Subrogation, the litigation podcast about how to recover your damages from the people who caused them. We are your hosts. I'm Rebecca Wright.
And I'm Steve Elsif, and we are both experienced civil litigators and partners at Rathbone Group.
As you listen to our podcast, if you have questions or comments, please email us at podcast@rathbonegroup.com.
Or you can visit our website, www.rathbonegroup.com.
Hey, Steve.
Yes.
You ever walk in on a scene in your house where your kids have done something ridiculous and made like a huge mess, like opened a bag of flour all over the kitchen or something like that?
I mean, just every day.
Only every day. And I don't know about your kids, but when I walk into a scene on this, the first reaction that I get from these lovely angelic children is, I didn't do it.
I didn't do it, or we don't know what happened.
If yeah. only. If only there was a way. And their implication when they look up at you with those angelic eyes and say, I didn't do it, is somehow this bag of flour magically opened and threw itself all over the kitchen.
How lucky for me that I am a detective as well as a father.
How
I can piece this
you.
Whole scene together.
And in fact, there's a legal theory for that. And it's in Latin, no less.
Oh, that's perfect. What's it called?
It is called Res Ipsa Loquitur. And it is a doctrine in tort law that allows the plaintiff to meet its burden of proof with circumstantial evidence. So what happens is that the plaintiff is able to create a rebuttable presumption of negligence by proving that the harm that was caused to the plaintiff would not have ordinarily occurred without negligence.
That's correct. So basically, if there is no direct evidence of a defendant's negligence, no one saw exactly what happened, or for whatever reason, the evidence doesn't exist, the plaintiff can then use circumstantial evidence to establish the negligence, basically allowing the unusual accident or the unusual circumstances. And if you can prove what the unusual circumstances are, the jury would be permitted to use its own common sense to draw whatever obvious conclusion was that it was the defendant's fault.
That's right. And you mentioned the jury because res ipsa loquitur is at its core an evidence issue. Mm-hmm. And what you're usually looking for when you're talking about res ipsa loquitur is a jury instruction, an instruction to the finder of fact that says, there's this doctrine called res ipsa loquitur, and you can apply it here if the plaintiff was able to meet the three required elements. Mm-hmm. And those three elements are, one, that the accident is of a kind which does not ordinarily occur in the absence of someone's negligence. Two, that it was caused by something within the exclusive control of the defendant. And three, that it was not due to any act on the part of the injured party. So let's return to our kitchen explosion, mm-hmm. our kitchen flower explosion and our angelic children standing there. So the accident is of a kind which does not normally occur in the absence of someone's negligence. So there's flour all over the kitchen. That doesn't typically occur. Flour doesn't typically hurl itself all over the kitchen. Mm-hmm. There are ways that that can happen, but it generally involves someone's negligence, something that somebody did. It was caused by something within the exclusive control of the, let's say, of the children in our example. So mm-hmm. if the children were in the kitchen alone, there were no other people in there, and they had exclusive control over this bag of flour because they were suspiciously in the pantry or near the pantry at the time that it happened. Mm-hmm. And that it was not due to any act on the part of the injured party. So assuming that we, the parents, are the injured party, the aggrieved party, because we're the ones who are going to have to clean up the mess, but we didn't do anything to cause the flour to get thrown all over the kitchen, then theoretically, we would be entitled to to a jury instruction on res ipsa loquitur.
And which the mechanism then shifts the burden to the defendant to prove that they weren't negligent. And they can do this in a number of ways, basically by attacking the three elements that we mentioned before. So they would argue that this event could happen without negligence, or they would argue that they weren't in exclusive control. I'm sensing a poltergeist defense there in the flower example.
Or the dog or the cat.
Mm-hmm. There's a number of ways that they could shift the burden back to the plaintiff to prove that they were negligent, and that would be the most direct way, to take those elements and prove one of them to be not applicable to the circumstances. And it's funny that you mentioned flour, in as much as the first res ipsa case involved a barrel of flour. This is from The 1863 English case, Byrne versus Bodle. I'm going to say Bodle. It's B-O-A-D-L-E.
I mean, I feel like you should say it in a British accent, but sure.
Again, I can't do that. I think we've covered that my English accent is an insult to English people and myself. So, in we're going to say Byrne versus Bodle. In Byrne versus Bodle, a plaintiff is walking along the street. He's clearly able to be on the sidewalk where he is. A barrel falls out of a flour production factory and strikes him on the head and causes his damages. No one sees exactly what happened. No one saw why the barrel fell out of the window. There was a witness that saw the barrel falling, but that really doesn't help. We all know that the barrel fell out of the window. So he was able to show that this is an event that normally doesn't occur unless someone has acted negligently, that the evidence or the instrumentality of the damage was in the exclusive control of the flour factory, and that the type of negligence was in the scope of the defendant's duty to the plaintiff. In other words, they have a duty to people walking down the street not to have, you know, crazy barrels falling on top of their head. And this was the first case where res ipsa loquitur was used, and it shifted the burden onto the factory to show that they had not acted negligently.
That's right. And clearly the plaintiff, who was simply walking down the street, did not commit any negligence himself, and the damage was not due to any act on his part. Mm-hmm. And so that case did satisfy the three prongs of res ipsa loquitur, and in fact established. Another case cited in law school textbooks was Ibarra v. Spangard, which is a California case from 1944. Now, Ibarra v. Spangard is often cited as the standard for res ipsa loquitur because here's the situation. There was a patient in a hospital, and he was having appendectomy surgery. Mm-hmm. And when he woke up, he came to find that he had suffered trauma to his shoulder during appendix surgery. Now, I'm not a doctor, neither are you, but I do know approximately where the appendix is located in a normal human body.
I can ballpark it.
Right? And it's not nowhere near a shoulder. And so what the court found in Ibarra is, again, that the plaintiff was able to satisfy the three prongs to establish res ipsa loquitur, that the accident is of a kind which does not normally occur in the absence of someone's negligence. The damage to the shoulder during appendix surgery was necessarily due to someone's negligence. That it was caused by something within the exclusive control of the defendant. Mm-hmm. You're in a surgical suite. The folks in that suite, who are all agents of the hospital in this case, they had exclusive control over the patient's body at that point, and that it must not have been due to any act on the part of the injured party. Well, that was an easy one for Ibarra v. Spangard because, of course, the injured party was unconscious at the time.
Yeah.
And so that is one that is often cited. And in fact, medical cases seem to be the most often cited examples for the concept of res ipsa loquitur.
That's absolutely correct. On all the cases I found in Indiana where they recognize that the doctrine applies have all been medical cases. And the examples here I pulled were when a surgeon operates on the wrong limb, for example, or a patient's oxygen mask in one case caught fire during the surgery. So
that does seem bad. I mean, and like it's attributable to negligence of someone's part.
The craziest things happen during surgery. Or when there are, as you mentioned, foreign objects left inside of a patient's body after a surgery, a sponge or an instrument, a speculum or something like that. And there was another case where there was a wire left inside a patient's breast after a biopsy. All of these are medical cases, all of these are cases where res ipsa was found to apply.
That's right, because what courts have found is that in establishing the first prong of res ipsa loquitur, that the accident is of a kind which does not ordinarily occur in the absence of someone's negligence, the act causing the injury is so palpably negligent that it may be inferred as a matter of law. And so that's all those examples that you were just talking about, leaving foreign objects in bodies, amputating the wrong limb, so on and so forth. All of these things are so palpably negligence that you can infer as a matter of law that there is negligence there that caused the injury. Mm-hmm. When the general experience and observation of mankind teaches that the result would not be expected without negligence, and when proof by experts in an esoteric field creates an inference that negligence caused the injuries. So we're really looking, when we are looking to apply res ipsa loquitur, we are looking for something that is clear-cut negligence. Somebody's exactly. negligence caused this. And that's very important because the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur, as fun as it is to talk about as a legal doctrine, is heavily disfavored by courts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's hard to get an instruction on this because there are so many different ways that injuries can come about. There are so many different ways that, for example, you mentioned fires. There, and this has actually been held in Ohio courts, that fires can be started in all different kinds of ways that don't involve negligence. So you're not going to get, under usual circumstances, the res ipsa instruction in an Ohio fire. The case that came out in Ohio involved a bowling alley, and there were actually two defendants in the bowling alley. There were refinishing pins in the basement of the bowling alley, and they were using a flammable liquid to do the refinishing. There's a big blank here in the evidence, and then there's a fire that starts and burns down not only the bowling alley but the building above it. They didn't get the res ipsa instruction there, not because it wasn't, you know, common sense would dictate almost exactly what probably happened, but the judge held that fires happen all different kinds of ways, and in this case, it doesn't have to be negligence for a fire to start.
Right, and similarly, there was another case, actually just this year in 2018, in a Steelin versus Cabela's Wholesale Inc. This is a South Dakota case out of the South Dakota Supreme Court, and I think this is an interesting one because it's the kind of case that, on its surface, sounds like a good res ipsa case. So Ms. Stalin was in a Cabela's, it's like a camping, hunting, sporting goods store. Mm-hmm. So she's in this store in South Dakota, and she's walking through the aisles, and her shoulder brushes against, they say, a heavy drop-down steel receiver hitch, like a camping hitch. So the hitch fell from the shelving unit, and it hit Ms. Stalin's wrist. And because of the damage to her wrist, she was actually unable to work for nearly 4 years. So she argued that she was entitled to a res ipsa loquitur instruction to the jury. And the argument was that the hitch was under the full control of Cabela's employees, that the hitch would not normally fall from its shelving unit if due care had been exercised by the employees. And here they noted that the hitches were held up by like a very thin strand of metal, and that she didn't do anything to cause the damage. Well, seems pretty good, but the court disagreed, and she appealed it, and then the Supreme Court of South Dakota disagreed with her as well. They found that there were two reasons why res ipsa did not apply to this circumstance. And number one is the very fact that what we were talking about is a merchandise display offered for public sale. What the court said was, listen, when you've got a merchandise display that's offered for public sale and it's in the aisle of a store like this, it is ordinarily handled and manipulated by customers. Mm-hmm. So somebody else could have altered that display in some way, could have rearranged it, could have shifted things, could have moved things, could have weakened that attachment or whatever the case may be. And so that goes directly to the second prong of the required elements, that it has to be caused by something within the exclusive control of the defendant. Once the defendant put that display out in the aisleway on public display, and once other customers, third parties, were able to handle it, then it took that display out of the exclusive control of the defendant. In addition, the court noted that, as Ms. Stalin testified, she brushed the hitch with her shoulder before it fell. So she herself manipulated that display. She herself may have committed some sort of act, she, the injured party, may have committed some sort of act that contributed to the damage. And that's the third prong for res ipsa loquitur. And so in that way, the Supreme Court of South Dakota confirmed what the lower court had stated, that she was not entitled to an instruction on res ipsa loquitur to the jury.
Another good example of rebutting the second and third prongs here came out of California in a 1948 case, Larson versus St. Francis Hotel. And this is going to sound a lot like Byrne and Bodle. It was August 14th, 1945. This is actually known as VJ Day. It's the day that Japan surrendered and World War II came to an end. So people are having a wonderful time. It's a day of a lot of celebration and, I imagine, alcohol. So she's walking along the street. This is in San Francisco. A heavy armchair comes out of the hotel window and lands on her, causing her injuries.
I'm sorry, an armchair fell out of the window?
Absolutely, an armchair falls out of a window.
This sounds like a cartoon.
Would you rather be hit by an armchair or a barrel of flour? Now we're on a different topic.
So, I'm going to have to know more about this armchair.
So she brings a case against the hotel, arguing that the hotel's negligence was proven by the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur. The trial court And the California Court of Appeals disagreed. The Court of Appeals held that hotels do not have exclusive control over the furniture in their rooms. And this is obvious by the fact that the hotel guests have at least some partial control over the furniture, and that would defeat the application of the doctrine.
Ah, so that's similar to the Cabela case, where they said there are third parties mm-hmm. who may have manipulated this. A drunken hotel guest could have thrown that chair out of the window.
If it were a hotel that weren't open yet, like if it were just mm-hmm. you know, closed that day for renovations or something like that, then you're looking at a little bit closer. Mm-hmm. Who else is in the hotel, though? If it's only hotel employees, top to bottom in this hotel, I think you got a good case.
Right.
If it's a hotel open to the public and every room is full, you know, no vacancies, and who knows where this armchair came from, you know, you're looking at another person, a third party.
I suppose if you could somehow prove that it happened during the time that the room was being cleaned mm-hmm. or something like that. But of course, in 1945, my guess is they didn't have records like that.
Well, here we go back into why we have race ipsa in the first place. If we knew what happened, we wouldn't need it.
That's right. That's exactly right. And I think the timing of your case is interesting, that you said the decision came down in 1948. Is that correct?
1948 case, yes.
Yes. And the loss occurred in 1945. And that is 1 year after the Ibarra v. Spangard case, where California applied res ipsa loquitur to the medical case. So it sounds like what you probably had at that time was some folks who said, oh, wow, what a great concept this is. We are going to have a lot easier time proving our cases up now.
Mm-hmm. It was the hot legal theory at the time.
Woohoo!
Res ipsa. Because as we discussed before, it's good for plaintiffs because it takes the burden off of, you know, you don't have to prove what happened, especially in these cases where, you know, if it's the medical malpractice thing, you just wake up, you have no idea what happened.
That's exactly right. And really, that's what res ipsa is for. It's for cases where the negligence is clear-cut, but there's some sort of absence of evidence. And what courts have found is that the doctrine should be invoked sparingly and only when facts and demands of justice make its application essential. It really only when there's no other way to provide justice for the plaintiff. It is only where the circumstances leave no room for different presumptions or inferences that the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur applies. But that doesn't mean that it never applies, because I have a case from 2010 from Washington, for the Supreme Court of Washington, which actually sat en banc to hear this case. So in other words, all the judges of the Washington Supreme Court heard this case and made this decision in 2010. So in Curtis versus Lean, we had a tenant who lived on this farmland property. Okay. She didn't work on the farm. She just lived on the property. Mm-hmm. And on this property was a pond that was agreed to be sort of a decorative pond. And although the grandchildren of the property owners sometimes swam in the pond, but otherwise it was decorative. The owners of the land had put a dock on the pond so that they could access a drainage pipe that was out into the pond a bit. So this tenant goes walking out onto the wooden dock. It was the first time she'd ever done it. She goes and walks onto the dock, and the wooden boards immediately gave way. And her leg went through the dock all the way up to her hip. She fell into the dock. And as she did this, she sustained a hairline fracture to her tibia. So the argument against applying res ipsa loquitur was that she could not eliminate all other possible causes or inferences for what happened. But the court found that that's not necessary. The Washington Supreme Court, and again, en banc, all of the judges there on this one, held that a plaintiff claiming res ipsa loquitur is not required to eliminate with certainty all other possible causes or inferences in order for res ipsa loquitur to apply. That the doctrine allows the plaintiff to establish a prima facie case of negligence when he or she cannot prove a specific act of negligence because he or she is not in a situation where knowledge of the specific act is available to the plaintiff. Once the plaintiff establishes the prima facie case, the defendant must then offer an explanation, if he can, that shows that he wasn't negligent. So this takes us back to the burden shifting, that the plaintiff doesn't have to disprove absolutely everything. They don't have to eliminate all other causes, because what will happen with res ipsa loquitur is that the burden shifts to the defendant, and then the defendant has the opportunity to provide some explanation outside of his own negligence. So the court found in Curtis that she showed that the accident was of a type that would not ordinarily happen in the absence of negligence, because general experience says that properly maintained wooden docks don't give way. Mm-hmm. that there was no evidence that the dock was not in the exclusive control of the landowners. And it's important to note in this case that the landowners actually did still live on the property. And this tenant lived on the property as well, although not in the same building. And that it was uncontested that the tenant did not contribute in any way to the accident. And so, therefore, the Supreme Court of Washington found that the res ipsa loquitur jury instruction was appropriate. They did note, however, that whether the inference of negligence arising from res ipsa loquitur would be convincing to the jury is another story. And again, the court is not deciding, okay, res ipsa loquitur applies, and therefore you get a judgment.
Judgment for the plaintiff, right.
Right.
It's all up to the jury, and what weight they give the res ipsa instruction is entirely up to the jury.
Exactly. And so what you're not going to see much of is res ipsa loquitur summary judgments.
No.
Because by definition, there's an issue of fact there.
Exactly.
So you can see the different ways that different courts have chosen to apply this concept, that you've got the South Dakota court, which is applying a very difficult standard for it, and the Washington court, which is saying, well, it is a high standard, but the plaintiff doesn't have to disprove every possible situation, that some of that is for the defendant to prove.
Mm-hmm. And one last way I think that you can get around res ipsa as a defendant is if you could establish that you don't owe the plaintiff a duty of care under the law. And that's kind of more of a negligence defense in general than a res ipsa defense. But if you can prove that the injury doesn't fall within the scope of the duty that you owe to this person, and if it's a trespasser or someone who's not standing where they should be standing at the time of the injury, even if they're not acting negligently or contributing to their own injuries, if they are trespassing, you owe a different duty. And if you don't owe a duty of care to this person to prevent their injuries and they get injured, depending on the circumstances, you can escape negligence altogether. So you may get the res ipsa loquitur instruction to the jury, and then they find that there's no duty owed, and then there's a judgment for the defendant, a directed verdict.
That's exactly right, because what res ipsa does is it is a way to prove negligence, mm-hmm. but negligence still requires duty, breach, causation, and correlated damages. Mm-hmm. So if there's no duty, like you said, then there's not going to be any negligence. Mm-hmm. Have you ever argued res ipsa in a court case regarding subrogation?
As you know, most cases don't go to jury trials. Most cases don't actually get super close to a jury trial. The closest you usually get would be a couple months out, and that's when everybody comes to their senses and realizes that it's probably a good time to start settling. So you don't get too close to jury instructions that often. And I have argued to opposing counsel, this would be a case where I would argue for a res ipsa instruction for the jury. And typically, if you have those sorts of discussions with the other side, you're looking at settling anyway, because you're trying to put forth what your best case is going to be, and they're going to try and put forth what their best defense is going to be. I've never had to argue a motion in limine for a jury instruction on res ipsa. It's just one of those things that doesn't come up that often, especially in our context where a large percentage of our cases deal with automobile accidents, and automobile accidents factually just don't lend themselves to this sort of instruction. Automobile accidents can happen in so many different ways, and it is so fact dependent that it's just almost impossible to argue, even in rear end cases, that one party absolutely had to be negligent.
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. There's too much else that could cause the damage.
Yeah, even in rear-end accidents, they can be caused by one party stopping short or faulty brakes on the part of the defendant's car, sliding on the road if the road isn't exactly perfect. There's just, a lot of variables, and it's not clear-cut enough. It's not a barrel falling out of a window.
Right. It's not so palpably negligent that it lends itself to an inference of negligence.
And in auto cases, the examples I've seen argued have been, there was a case where a defendant had gone left of center. Everyone agrees that the collision happened in the plaintiff's lane, where the defendant drifted left of center, and it was a head-on collision. And the defendant was deceased as a result of the collision. So he or she is not giving any evidence here as to what happened. Res ipsa wasn't applied in that case because it was found that one of the tires on the defendant's car had gone flat, and that can happen with negligence. So, if you maintain your car poorly, or it can happen, just running over a nail or something like that, some unforeseen incident can cause the tire to go flat. The flat tire could cause the car to pull off into the, into left of center. Hmm. So you don't get a res ipsa instruction even on that. Another example that I see all the time in a property context is where you have a stationary building, such as someone's house or shed, and a car goes through it. And I've seen this case a number of times.
Oh, yes.
Somebody just winds up driving into someone's house.
Mm-hmm.
And you would think res ipsa loquitur, you've got them, because the house didn't jump out in front of that car.
Right.
If anything, it had to have been negligent.
The third prong is easy, because mm-hmm. clearly your insured didn't do anything to cause that
Nothing.
Loss.
Nothing. He was standing where he was supposed to be, most likely. So res ipsa doesn't apply in those cases to any degree of certainty, because there's a number of ways why that defendant would have driven off the road. Again, could have been a flat tire, but it also could be the defendant could have a seizure, or any number of medical emergencies could cause this.
Well, and in that situation, though, you could conceivably make the res ipsa argument, because it would then put the burden on the defendant to prove that, in fact, there was such a medical mm-hmm. issue. But in those kinds of cases, you really don't need the res ipsa argument, because you're already able to prove the negligence. I had one of those cases, the car in the house case, where a defendant came around a corner too fast and went off the road, actually caught air because she cleared a row of hedges that was in the front yard of our insured's home. Her car went over the hedges.
It's like Dukes of Hazzard.
She totally did. And then she landed in our insured's living room.
Not as awesome.
Less awesome. Lots of damage. And so in that situation, sure, you can infer that there was negligence, except for the fact that it's possible that there was an animal that ran out in the road. It's possible, mm-hmm. such and such. But also we can say that, it's likely that she was speeding. She was coming around that bend way too fast, and she was going fast enough to clear the hedge. So, even if an animal did run out, she shouldn't have been going that fast. So the point is that we were able to prove the negligence enough that we didn't even need to think about a res ipsa argument or a res ipsa instruction. There was enough there to prove a straight negligence case.
Mm-hmm. I was once in an automobile accident with a friend of mine. We were driving down the road, and it was at some point he looks down and there is a spider on his leg, and he freaks out, and in his trying to get the spider off his leg, he knocked the car into reverse as we're driving.
Oh, jeez.
So it's terrible for the car. The transmission
right.
doesn't like that at all. But it caused us to go off the road and hit a few things. Negligence, not really. Sudden emergency, maybe. I don't know.
It was definitely negligence.
It depends on your reaction to a spider, I guess. If it's completely involuntary, I don't know. I don't know what you'd say on this case. But, we all knew what happened. So res ipsa wouldn't come into it, because the facts were evident as to what happened. We got out of the car and told everyone.
Right.
So
res ipsa loquitur is... It's an interesting concept. It's a good tool for cases where there's some sort of blank in the evidence
mm-hmm.
That's not available to the plaintiff for some reason. But it's really only applicable in very narrow circumstances. You have to be able to show that this wouldn't have happened except for negligence. You have to be able to show that it was caused by something that was within the exclusive control of the defendant, and you have to be able to show that the plaintiff did not play any part in causing his or her own injury.
Mm-hmm.
And barring those very specific circumstances, res ipsa is probably not going to apply. But fortunately, there are a myriad other negligence theories out there that may. Well, if you would like more information on res ipsa loquitur, or if you'd like to suggest a future topic or refer a file, please contact us at podcast@rathbonegroup.com.
As always, visit our website, rathbonegroup.com, and subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and make sure you smash that like button or the 4-star button, or write us a review, let us know what you think.
Unless you don't like us, in which case, skip this.
Yeah, go ahead and keep it to yourself. That's fine.
We'd like to thank Ralph DiSilvestro for composing and performing our intro and outro music, and invite you to join us again soon on Subrogation.